Dear friends, may I take this opportunity to welcome you all here today on behalf of the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. The UUFM is a safe haven for spiritual, intellectual, and emotional growth, an incubator for the next generation of UUs, vibrant, open, and inspirational in what we say and do, a bold bottle of love, compassion, social action, and justice for ourselves, our society, and our planet. We're builders of bridges across faiths and boundaries to honor our shared humanity and common values, and a visible beacon of liberal religious messages of hope and meaning in our local community. It's wonderful, as always, to see all of the familiar faces of our friends and all the special members of our congregation. I know that you all join me this morning in extending a heartfelt and sincere welcome to all of our new members and any visitors who may be joining us today. Welcome, one and all. If you have a guest with you that you'd like to introduce, please raise your hand and we'll find out if there's a microphone. Would anyone like to introduce a guest they may have with them today? Every guest is welcome, whether introduced or not. Thank you. I'd like to turn your attention to the announcements in your order of service. There's a lot of great information in there. And in particular, I want to call your attention to next Sunday, September 13th. September 13th is our Musicale, an annual event much awaited and looked forward to. And following the Musicale, immediately following service, we will have our startup workshop with our new developmental minister, Reverend John Alou Johnstone. That workshop is for everyone in the congregation. It will be facilitated by Nancy Hege of Mid-America Region UUA. It'll be about an hour's length right after the workshop, and there will be some light refreshments provided. So please mark your calendar, and if you can, plan to stay an extra hour next Sunday. I need to draft a chalice lighter. Do I have any? I do have a volunteer. Excellent. Thank you very much. Ms. Sayre, what's your first name? Leah Sayre. Ms. Leah Sayre will be lighting our chalice. Leah, I'm going to say just a few words, and then I'll give you a cue. Today, on International Workers' Day, it's fitting that we light the chalice in honor of not only hard work, but also the conviction to improve the lives of working people everywhere. The labor organizer Mother Mary Harris Jones was a hellraiser in many workers' battles for fairness, including the fight for the 8-hour workday. Mother Jones said, "I am not afraid of the pen or the scaffold or the sword. I will speak the truth wherever I please." May we feel the bravery of her conviction as we meditate upon the flame. Please join me in singing opening hymn number 134, Our World is One World. Stand as you're able.
I invite the children up to join me over here. for a story. The story that I have for you this morning comes from Nigeria. Do you know where Nigeria is? Anybody know where Nigeria is? It's in Africa. Yeah, it's in Africa. So this is a Nigerian folk tale about the sky. And they say that many, many years ago, long, long, long time ago, the sky was very close to the earth. And in fact, people could reach up and touch it. Even the littlest people could reach up and touch it. And not only could you reach up and touch it, but you could break off pieces of it and eat them. And so that's how the people ate. They reached up and broke off pieces and ate them. So sometimes they tasted like mango, and sometimes they tasted like pineapple, and sometimes they tasted like goat stew. But they always were able to eat whenever they wanted to just by reaching up and taking a piece of sky. So that meant that nobody had to work. They got to just do whatever they wanted to. They told stories, and they made art, and they just had fun all the time. So in this kingdom, there was a tradition of having a great festival every once in a while, and King Oba invited everybody to the festival. But one of the things that had happened is that the sky had noticed that sometimes people took advantage of it, that sometimes people took more than they could eat, and then they'd hide it away in little holes or in garbage cans underneath everything else. And the sky was feeling a little bit miffed at this. And so the sky got a little cloudy and had some little flashes of lightning and said to King Oba, "You must tell your people not to waste me or it'll be a problem. I might just go away, a long way away." So King Oba gathered the people for the festival, and they had a great festival. They were having singing and dancing, and they were doing some special things with the pieces of the sky and making them fancier and making them really pretty. But King Oba, before the festival, said to everyone, "You must be careful, because the sky has warned us that if you waste the sky, if you do not respect the sky, then it's going to go away. So we're going to have a great time, but be careful." Well, there was one woman, Adine. Now, she was known as kind of greedy. She had a lot of bracelets, but she didn't feel like she had enough, because she wanted them to be coral bracelets. And she had some coral necklaces, but she wanted more coral necklaces. And she had 11 children, but she wanted more. And what she most wanted more of was food. She always wanted more food. She loved, loved, loved to eat. So she heard the warning, and she said, "Okay, we're going to be careful. We're not going to take more than what we need." So they had a great festival. They sang and they danced and they told stories and they ate and ate and ate. You know how it is at a festival? And ate and ate and ate. And everybody was full and went home happy. Now, Adine, as she went home, was thinking about those wonderful mango tastes that were in the sky and those wonderful pineapple tastes. And she thought, "Oh, I just want another taste." And she reached up to the sky and took a little more. And it was so good. She thought, "Oh, a little more won't matter." And she broke off a hunk of the sky. And then she realized, "Oh, no, this is a huge hunk of sky. I can't eat all this by myself." But she tried. But she couldn't eat it all by herself. She took it home to her husband. She said, "Husband, you must help me to eat this sky." He says, I just came from the festival. I ate so much. She said, no, help me eat the sky. So he took a little bit and a little bit. She called all her 11 children and said, come on, you must help me eat all the sky. And so they took some little pieces and ate some pieces of the sky, but they couldn't eat very much. She called her neighbors in, please help me eat the sky. We can't waste it. And they ate some little bits, but there was still some left. And so she just broke it up in little pieces and hid it under all the garbage, hoping that the sky wouldn't notice. But then the sky, the clouds got dark and came in and the lightning flashed and the sky said, that's it, I'm going away. And it got higher and higher and higher and it went away so that the people couldn't even touch the sky anymore. It was gone. And Adonai just started crying, the tears rolling down her face. What will we do? What will we eat? And the tear rolled down her face and went all the way and touched the earth. And the earth said, I can feed the people, but I will not be taken advantage of the way the sky was. The people must learn to plow and plant and harvest and cook. Even the children will help by fetching water and sticks so that you can boil things in big kettles. I'll provide your food, but you must work to get it. And so that is the story of why the sky is far away from the Nigerian people. And it's time to go to your classes.
A beloved community not only nurtures one another's spiritual and intellectual growth, we also embrace each other's humanity by sharing our highest joys as well as the heavy burdens of our hearts. Please raise your hand if you'd like to share a joy or sorrow, and Mark will kindly bring the microphone over to you. This is a quiet group today. And that's okay.
Well, I'll share something. Today will be the day, which happens about twice a year, when I get to cut my wife's hair. She doesn't want to go to the barber to have her long hair, as you guys know, cut just straight across the back. So I get to do that. That's my joy.
What an honor.
Since nobody's saying anything, I'm Harriet Yonke, and I overcame fear yesterday. We both rode the zip line four lines with my grandchildren.
Well, I'm glad to be back with all of you and not sick. That's awesome. And also, so officially with the start of school, I have no more elementary children. Very sad.
Anel Furster and I are, I'm Ruth Friedman, we are planning a trip on October 2nd to New York City to see the painting in the Woman in Gold movie.
By sharing, may our joys multiply, and may our burdens feel lighter, resting on the strength of our shared shoulders. Please join me now in singing hymn 312, Here on the Paths of Every Day. Giving to our community is a sign of commitment to one another. The French writer Albert Camus wrote, "Real generosity toward the future lies in giving all to the present." Please embody generosity in your own way. Live the UUFM mission through your gifts of time, talent, and treasure. And today, I want to take an opportunity to not only thank one of our regular pianists who is with us today, Renee Reisner, whose gifts and talents we enjoy almost every week. I also want to introduce a special guest that we have here with us. We're fortunate to have guest pianist Amanda Krieg, am I saying that correctly, who is a student of Slavomir Dobrowski. And for the offertory, Amanda will play Intermezzo Opus 118, number 6, by Johannes Brahms. We have two wonderful readings today. The first is about the nature of work broadly, and the second is a more specific, it's a poem, and it's more specifically about the work of making the garments that we wear. This first piece is called From Letters to My Son, Reflections on Becoming a Man by Kent Nerburn. No matter how much you might believe that your work is nothing more than what you do to make money, your work makes you who you are because it is where you put your time. I remember several years ago when I was intent upon building my reputation as a sculptor, I took a job driving a cab because, as I told people, I want a job that I'll never confuse with a profession. Yet within 6 months, I was talking like a cab driver, thinking like a cab driver, looking at the world through the eyes of a cab driver. My anecdotes came from my job, as did my observations about life. I became embroiled in the personalities and politics of the company for which I worked and developed the habits and rhythms of life that went with my all-night driving shift. On the days when I did not drive and instead worked on my sculpture, I still carried the consciousness of a cab driver with me. Whether I liked it or not, I was a cab driver. This happens to anyone who takes a job. Even if you hate the job and keep a distance from it, you are defining yourself in opposition to the job by resisting it. By giving the job your time, you are giving it your consciousness, and it will, in turn, fill your life with the reality that it presents. We are what we do, and the more we do it, the more we become it. The only way out is to change our lives or to change our expectations for our lives. And if we lower our expectations, we're killing our dreams. And a person without dreams is already half dead. What you need to do is think of work as vocation. This word may seem stilted in its tone, but it has a wisdom within it. It comes from the Latin for calling, which comes from the word for voice. In those meanings, it touches on what work really should be. It should be something that calls to you as something you want to do. And it should be something that gives voice to who you are and what you want to say to the world. A vocation is something you feel compelled to do, or at least something that fills you with a sense of meaning. It is, above all else, something that lets you love. And now I'd like to ask Lindsay Smith to come forward and share that more specific idea of work in a poem.
This is a shirt by Robert Pinsky. The back, the yoke, the yardage, lapped seams, the nearly invisible stitches along the collar, turned in a sweatshop by Koreans or Malaysians, gossiping over tea and noodles on their break, or talking money or politics while one fitted this arm piece with its overseam to the band. Of cuff, I button at my wrist. The presser, the cutter, the wringer, the mangle, the needle, the union, the threadle, the bobbin, the code, the infamous blaze at the Triangle Factory in 1911. 146 died in the flames on the ninth floor, no hydrants, no fire escapes. The witness in a building across the street who watched how a young man helped a girl to step up to the windowsill, then held her out, away from the masonry wall and let her drop, and then another, as if he were helping them up to enter a streetcar and not eternity. A third before he dropped her, put her arms around his neck and kissed him. Then he held her into space and dropped her. Almost at once, he stepped to the sill himself, his jacket flared, and fluttered up from his shirt as he came down, air filling up the legs of his gray trousers. Like Hart Crane's bedlamite, shrill shirt ballooning. Wonderful how the pattern matches perfectly across the placket and over the twin bar tacked corners of both pockets like a strict rhyme, or a major chord, prints, plaids, checks, houndstooth, Tattersall, Madras, the clan tartans, invented by mill owners, inspired by the hoax of Ossian, to control their savage Scottish workers, tamed by a fabricated heraldry, MacGregor, Bailey, McMartin, the kilt devised for workers to wear among the dusty clattering looms, weavers, carters, spinners, the loader, the docker, the navy, the planter, the picker, the sorter, sweating at her making in a litter of cotton, as slaves in calico head rags sweated in the fields. George Herbert, your descendant, is a black lady in South Carolina. Her name is Irma, and she inspected my shirt, its color and fit, and feel and its clean smell have satisfied both her and me. We have culled its cost and quality down to the buttons of simulated bone. The buttonholes, the sizing, the facing, the characters, printed in black on neck band and tail, the shape, the label, the labor, the color, the shade, the shirt.
UUFM's own music director, Michael Oldfather, will perform a special piece in honor of Labor Day, Joe Hill, about the famed Wobbly Union organizer. The song is written by Alfred Hayes and Earl Robinson.
Friday. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me, says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake, Joe, by God, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I ain't dead. Says Joe, I didn't die. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, but I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, it takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. I skipped a verse. Let's do this right. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, Joe says what they forgot to kill, went on to organize. Joe Hill ain't dead, he says to me. Joe Hill ain't never died. Where working men are out on strike, Joe Hill is at their side. Joe Hill is at their side. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, says he, you'll find Joe Hill. Says he, you'll find Joe Hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me, says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate all the different kinds of music that we get to enjoy. Remember the fire at the Bangladeshi garment factory in 2012 that killed 112 workers? Just this week, the owners, managers, and security guards were finally indicted for homicide. It wasn't terrorism that slaughtered 112 people. It wasn't even hatred. To the people who ran this factory, the people who worked there didn't even merit such an intense emotion. They didn't even deserve enough attention to be sure they could be safe in case of a fire. It was more important to control their movement than to ensure their survival. Their lives were insignificant, weighed against profit. The Bangladeshi fire echoed a bit more than 100 years later, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in 1911 in Manhattan, New York, where 146 people died, mostly young women, new immigrants to the U.S., and just like in Bangladesh, owners and managers had locked exit doors. As the poem we heard describes, people jumped to their deaths. 62 people jumped to their deaths. And just like in Bangladesh, owners had cared more about management of their employees, preventing unauthorized leaving, than they did their safety. Just like in Bangladesh, they had evaded what building codes and regulations existed. Just like in Bangladesh, the owners were indicted. They were acquitted of manslaughter charges, but found liable of wrongful death in a civil suit. There's no way to understand what happened, either in New York in the early 20th century or in Bangladesh in this century, except as greed run wild. An example of how weighted the capitalist system can be toward capital over labor. The owners called the shots, and labor, especially individual workers, struggle to have a voice. And labor is what this weekend's celebrations are about. In much of the world, Labor Day is celebrated on May 1st. But in this country, the communist connotations of May Day make that impossible. But we haven't given up the September Labor Day, though most of the associations with it have become picnics and back-to-school sales, maybe with an occasional parade thrown in. But with very little attention to the concept of work, much less a nod to the unionists who established the holiday. And I don't like to let Labor Day pass unrecognized, because work is central to most people's lives. For many people, the only thing they do more than sleep is to work. And if something takes up that much of our life energy, it has to be included when we try to make meaning out of our lives. As the Nurburn readings reminds us, we spend so much time at our work that it changes us and shapes us into a particular mindset. Yet somehow the important role of work often gets neglected. Certainly it does in the religious realm. While church is one place where it can be a relief not to have to be our work role, well, you all can do that. I can't. Still, work does not receive a lot of focus. Our hymns hardly mention it. I don't know if it's just Unitarian Universalism or if it's a more general sense that religion and work somehow don't mix. They don't have anything to do with one another. But how can we understand our lives if we omit that big a piece of them? Not only should the experience of working demand our attention and reflection, but the labor movement itself holds meaning for us as you use because of how progressive values have been promoted by labor. As Samuel Gompers, the founder of the American Federation of Labor, AFL, wrote in the New York Times in 1910, Labor Day, quote, glorifies no armed conflict or battles of man's prowess over man. No martial glory or warlike pomp signals Labor Day. Rather, of all the days celebrated for one cause or another, there is not one which stands so conspicuously for social advancement of the common people as the first Monday in September, end quote. Social advancement of the common people. That's certainly something that fits my values and aspirations and intersects well with UU principles. We can't get to that social advancement of workers without talking about work. Work has so many meanings. Often the word implies a paid job, but we also speak of the chores we do around the house as work. We have works of art to decorate our workplaces. Inside an old-fashioned watch, the works work to tell the time. To work is to be employed, or to work hard is to sweat. If we try and try at something, when we succeed, we say, it worked! We work our way through a tangled web of brush when we're hiking or when we're studying through a tome filled with difficult concepts and big words. We work controls and miracles, crossword puzzles and calculus problems. Politicians work the room and their volunteers work the phones. The good old Anglo-Saxon word can be a noun or a verb, transitive or intransitive. It carries a lot of weight. It's a hefty word. And for some people, it may be meaningful that work is a four-letter word. Labor has some of the same characteristics, but not all of them. What's more, some of labor's meanings are deliberately collective. Labor means unions. And labor means the assortment of workers, unionized or not, people toiling for money in contrast to capital, the financial resources or investments that are the other part of producing goods. But before we get to labor in that sense, I'd like to think a little bit more about work. I love that Nigerian tale I told while the children were here. And does it remind you of something? There's another story of people eating in an unauthorized way that leads them to have to let go of their idyllic life of leisure and free food for a sentence of having to grow their own food, eking their living out of the earth. I'm talking about the Adam and Eve story, of course. As UUs, we consider those two stories in much the same light as narratives that have shaped a culture, giving us ways to think about who we are and how we live in the world. And the point of agreement between the two stories is the idea that at one time long ago, people's needs were taken care of without having to do anything. Rather, they broke off a piece of sky to eat, or they had free access to the fruits of all the trees except one. But being people, they tested the limits and wasted too much sky or ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and bam, now they have to plow and plant and work to get anything out of the ground that they can eat. They have to take care of themselves. What strikes me about both these stories is that they tell a psychological truth. We begin our lives as infants, fed and taken care of by others. And at some point, that stops. Maybe when we're 18. Maybe if we're lucky, when we're well into our 20s. Maybe if we're supremely unfortunate, we have to start worrying about where our food comes from when we're still children. The stories say that transition comes because we were greedy, or because we were too curious, or because we broke a rule. The truth is that transition comes because we are human. And we are adults able to care for ourselves. Yet there's a little sense of loss in recognizing that if we're going to eat, we have to work. In some families, that transition happens slowly, and in others, suddenly. Last year, I co-led a class about money and its meaning in our individual, congregational, and societal contexts. And we were able to reflect on the various messages that we had gotten about money and the tie-in with work. Because that's how most of us get our money. Some people were encouraged from childhood to apply themselves to work that would make them a healthy income. ideas of majoring in art or quitting school to start a business were discouraged or quashed. Some parents taught that the important thing in work was self-fulfillment, for others making a contribution to the world. And status figured in for some people. And many people's ideas about work change as they grow up and actually confront the working world. But those early models stick with us in ways we sometimes don't even comprehend. We may find ourselves judging people who do manual labor or who don't. Or we may be more concerned than we like about our status if the car we drive to work isn't new enough. And we may be genuinely shocked by our own attitudes because theoretically, at least, we believe in equal worth and dignity for everyone. Often the dignity of work doesn't rest so much in the work itself as in the attitude the worker takes toward the work. You may have seen the bit going around the internet lately about the doorman at a medical center who sings happy birthday to the bellies of pregnant women who come in to deliver. Now, that's not part of his job. I'm pretty sure that's not in the job description. But it's part of how he gives meaning to the job. The business consultant Peter Drucker shares the story about stone cutters in the Middle Ages, someone asking them what they are doing. And the first says, "I'm cutting stone. It's grueling work. It's sweaty and hard. It's horrid hauling rocks around, and when you cut, it's dangerous, working with the sharp tools and pieces of rock that can fall on you. I hate it, but it earns a living, and what choice do I have? I have a family to support." And the second one says, "Can't you see? I'm the best stone cutter in all the county. My work is of the highest quality, and you'll find no better if you travel for miles and miles." And the third one gets a gleam in his eye, and looks upward, says, "I'm building a cathedral to the glory of God." Now, our work can have different levels of meaning. For the first stone cutter, work had no meaning beyond the pay he received in return. He had a job to make a living, but not a life. The second stone cutter found identity in his work. His competitive instinct fueled pride in his craft. You could say he found meaning there. The third worker, though, found not just meaning and identity, but connection to a vision and value beyond himself. He was engaged in an enterprise that he did not begin and he would not complete, but that would be part, that he would be part of and contribute to. His work inspired him. Now, we modern UUs might scoff at the vision of creating a cathedral to the glory of God. The UUs who do believe in God tend more to think of God as an impersonal force or symbolic representation of the laws of nature or some such concept that could care less whether we build a cathedral, even if it is really beautiful. But there is something to be said for a vision that humbles us, that draws us together with others across time. Many cathedrals took generations to build, and that elevates the human spirit toward beauty. And you don't have to believe in God to buy into that kind of vision. It creates a sense of unity in contrast to the second guy whose work is centered in himself and his personal achievement. An aspiration, true, but a far littler aspiration in the end, no matter how fine his work was. So the unity of working together, that collective vision, is a page straight from the union organizer's playbook. It started in the late 18th century in the wake of the Industrial Revolution as crafts workers who had worked fairly independently came together to set rates, as guilds had in medieval times. Until the Industrial Revolution, skilled workers had maintained independence. But with the increase in mechanization and need for greater capital investments that produced factories, laborers became less self-sufficient and more likely to engage in wage labor than in self-employed craftsmanship. The journeymen of the Middle Ages, those in between independent master and the dependent apprentice, had become the factory employees of the 18th and 19th centuries. And most individuals found themselves with little negotiating power with an employer. That's still true. Unless you have highly desired, unusual skill sets, individual people don't have a lot of power to negotiate. As a collective, there's more power. And that's the foundation of labor philosophy. And that idea runs head on into the ideal of American individualism and the myth that we can make it on our own. The labor movement naturally shared some of the ideals of socialists who were committed to a common good above individual competition. And in fact, the unionists challenged many conventional notions. Joe Hill, whose tribute we heard sung earlier, a Swedish-born labor activist during the early 1800s, wrote many organizing songs himself, songs with a folk mood and the urgency of righteous demands. Most well-known may be The Preacher and the Slave. The song's a parody of the hymn in The Sweet By and By about going to heaven. And it talks about various shades of preachers and what he calls the starvation army, proclaiming to the downtrodden hungry, "You will eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky. Work and pray, live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die." So he sings that as the refrain, but in the final verse there's a bit of a reversal as Hill looks forward to the day when workers will have won the battle and their bosses will be hungry, and then the workers will see that the bosses will eat by and by after they've learned how to cook and fry and chop wood. So one of the many intriguing things about this song is how its roots in the progressive movement are tied up with the protest against predominant religious understandings of the time. Workers with some insight realized that not only were they exploited by their bosses, but that those bosses were supported in that exploitation by cultural influences, including religion. Churches were telling them that their future was not in this world, but in the next. The glory of afterlife would make up for the struggles of this life. And this deliberately undermined the determination of workers to push for bettering their circumstances in this life. The popularity of this and similar songs reminds us that turn-of-the-century populism mingled with working-class values and with doubt about traditional religion, which reminds me that skepticism about religious institutions does not require a college degree. Too often, I'm afraid, Unitarian Universalists have not made common cause with populist movements like labor because we've missed what we hold in common. Like Joe Hill and other union organizers who saw the need to make changes in this world, in this lifetime, UUs believe that what we do makes a difference and that we are charged to make the world a better place to live. We've gotten distracted sometimes and not noticed our common allies. And class discrimination has played a role in that. Unions are associated with laborers. Though that's certainly shifting as teachers' unions are among the largest in the country now, and public employees are more likely to be unionized than private ones. UUs have been more likely to be educated professionals, though that may be changing as well, as we recognize that, as I said earlier, it doesn't take a college degree to be critical of traditional religion. The status that work conveys is complicated. It's not just how much money we make. My brother, who's a contractor in the D.C. area, does most of his work with his hands, loves to taunt me because of how much less money I make than he does. "You have how many degrees?" he says. Yet my job has a different kind of prestige than his, whether or not either of us wants to acknowledge that. And I think this weird view of what is prestigious, as well as the cultural of individualism, shapes the lack of support we see for unions. The American attitude toward the labor movement hit a low around 2009, dipping under 50% favorability. And while individualism and status consciousness have pushed against the popularity of labor in the broad society, that's been true among UUs as well. Yet labor is relevant to all of us. Okay, a little survey. No elaborate technical systems here. I'm just going to ask you to raise your hands if you're willing. How many of you have ever belonged to a union? Okay. How many of you do now? Okay. Good. How many have family members currently in unions? How many have family members who've been in unions? Yeah. So today, less than 1 in 10 people in the U.S. belongs to a union. And it's actually slightly higher for women than it is for men. Now, how many of you have benefited from the labor movement? I think that's pretty much all of us. They've given us more than an annual day off for Labor Day. Unions championed the 8-hour workday, regulation of child labor, Social Security, and unemployment insurance, and, of course, the 40-hour work week. Of course, what's a 40-hour work week anymore? The idea that workers should receive overtime pay if they work more than 40 hours has weakened, and the reality that that limit applies to fewer and fewer workers is what influenced the current administration to make a change in the rules of who is exempt from the 40-hour work week. The problem was that employers defined positions as management when they paid not much more than $20,000 a year. And if someone's management, they no longer are entitled to a 40-hour work week, but they're expected to work until the job is done, even if they make barely enough to live on. So that has created blatant exploitation in the service industry, including fast food restaurants and retail stores. And when the labor movement is weak, labor rights are nibbled on. 39% of workers do not have sick leave. And you can bet that many of them work in places like restaurants where contagion is an issue. Even healthcare workers admit they come to work sick. We Americans brag on how we're the most productive workers in the world, but part of that is people working more than they're reported to be working who don't dare stay home for anything. Most of the world requires at least 24 hours off every week, paid vacation leave, paid maternity leave. Not the U.S. As labor unions have weakened, protections for all workers have collapsed. The middle class finds itself in shambles, and the entire economy has suffered. But you know this. You've seen the same things I have. Well-paid jobs that don't require a lot of education are drying up. Jobs from factory work to call centers, even some pretty technological jobs, moved to other countries, first Mexico, then China, India, Bangladesh, or they've been replaced by technology. We don't have file clerks or a typing pool anymore. Did anybody under 40 even know what a typing pool is? There used to be hordes of young women in every big company who made a living by typing. And in what factories we still have, productivity is up because so many things have been mechanized, eliminating jobs. I know young adults who work 3 part-time jobs without benefits, trying to cobble together enough to live on, pay off outrageous student loans, and cross their fingers that someday they might have enough money to get married, have children, or a house. Many older adults are unable to retire because they don't have enough money. Sandwich generation folks wonder how to help their parents out while trying to keep their kids from running up college debt. We know there's an economic strain more and more on American families. The inequality divide that Michael talked about a few weeks ago is locking some people out of the American dream, while a few have outrageous, if not obscene, success, and the middle holds on by their fingernails. And part of this picture is the decline of labor unions, a force that worked for people without influence individually who could collectively have an impact. But that less than 50% support for labor unions in 2009, that was a low point. Since then, support has grown to up again to around 58%. And intriguingly, the strongest support comes from young adults, 2/3 of whom approve of unions. There's huge popular support, too, for increasing minimum wages as one city after another raises the level, including Kansas City working up to $13 an hour in 2020. California even plans to vote on a $15 an hour minimum wage. And another substantial shift comes from the National Labor Relations Board, which is allowing unions to negotiate with parent companies who contract work to other agencies, other companies. The NLRB is also after companies who are trying to classify employees as independent contractors to get out of paying them legitimate salaries. So in some ways, trends are emerging in favor of labor, in favor of people who work to make a living. We have to remember, though, as important as the money and benefits are, there's more. There's dignity in work. There's even beauty and inspiration. It was the women trade unionists of the early 20th century, women who identified with those who died in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, who came up with the slogan, "Bread and Roses," the reminder that the worker needs more than a meal, that meaning matters. And before I close this sermon, there are a few minutes for some questions or comments, if anyone has any.
Thank you. Ken Ambrose. I'm really glad that you addressed this topic. So for so many years, I've looked at Labor Day and wondered, what is Labor Day? And then I realized that it was associated with May Day, and there was this communist involvement, and then there was this capitalistic plot to disassociate it with the communist. And so it's really great to hear your interest in this topic, and I think we should spread it to a larger audience. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I think it's important for us to see part of the history here that made it possible for people to organize back in the 30s, or the 20s, 30s, and so on. And that is, we had a Soviet Union and a communist world, which was a threat to the capitalist class. And so they had to make concessions. They had to make sure that workers weren't too radicalized, might be drifting over to the far left. And we don't have that anymore, and I think it's, and not to imply that the Soviet Union was a valid or good representation of socialism, but nevertheless, it was there, and it was a threat that had to be parlayed by making concessions to the U.S. working class. And without that, it's just that much more difficult.
Bryce Hobrock. We see a great deal today about the rise of the machine, that robots and automation are going to replace people in a very definite and probably unhealthy way. One of the most alarming things I've seen recently was an article in the New Yorker a couple of months ago about a venture capital firm in Silicon Valley who is determined to radically alter human values and work through the development of software. They're putting their money not just into new ideas, but in things that radically alter who we are and basically replace human workers as much as possible with machines and software. When asked, what are you going to do about all the people that are going to be made obsolete by this? Their answer is, well, all those people are going to be freed up for more and more leisure, and they can study the arts. Well, you've already answered the punch. You've already given the punchline here today about the meaning of work, that if people don't have work, there's no reason for them to exist.
I really like the idea of reflecting on your life and from the, I guess, angle of looking at the work that you've had. And Jack London's one of my favorite authors, and he had like a million jobs, and I think it's something that can kind of help you be empathetic with other people. And I feel like there's this kind of idea that you want to find a career as early as possible and then, you know, follow that ladder up as high as you can. And so sometimes I felt bad that I've had a variety of jobs. I remember when I was little, I had to help mop the drill floor in the armory when the mop was twice as tall as I was, and I still remember how I held the mop kind of craned between my shoulder and my neck. And I'd scoot along the floor. And since then, I've had a ton of different jobs, and I used to think that was kind of a bad thing, but I think the way that we're presenting it today, you could look at it as having a variety of angles, a variety of perspectives on life, so that's enjoyable.
Betty Banner, I just think that if we're questioning the role of work in our lives, one needs to look at the struggle many people have with retirement in terms of identity and use of time.
Jim Chanteau. I've always found it interesting that with governments that we don't like in other parts of the world, we value the rise of organized labor.
We liked it in Poland.
Yes, or we'd like it in China.
Uh-huh.
But in our own country, there seems to be the counter movement. We don't like the rise of organized labor because somehow that sounds like it's those other countries.
I think my comment might kind of follow on the tail of Jim's, and maybe Jim's comment speaks to the myth that workers don't need any protection in our free and democratic society, that somehow, right, as Adam Smith said, everything will be regulated by the hand of capitalism, which I have to say personally, as I've grown older and in my work life grown more mature, what I find is there's this huge divide between the culture of work and the culture of family. And American workers are at real odds to figure out how to do both. Although we have come a long way from those days of women and children and adults working 16-hour days in factories, and that was their family time. Maybe you saw your dad at the factory, right? Maybe you're working next to one another. Yes, we've come a long way, but we have not come far enough. It's so hard for people to reconcile these things.
Okay, well, let that be the last comment then. So we're thankful for the opportunity to work in whatever ways we do in our daily lives, shaping the world in the way we would like to see it evolve. We're grateful, too, for the accomplished work of the world, paid and unpaid, the growing of our food, the teaching of our children, the manufacture of the goods we use, the mining of materials needed for those goods, the entertainment that fills our leisure time, even the accounting, administration, management, and regulation that make everything else possible. Let's be grateful for all that work that's being done, for all the attention and care given to the details that make our lives. We need to give thanks. Those of us who have rewarding work need to appreciate the chance to contribute. At the same time, we recognize the challenges of work in our economy and culture, that some people, those we know and those we don't, even some of us here today, are unemployed or underemployed, not able to use their talents, skills, and energies to the fulfillment of themselves and the world. And others are stuck in jobs that do not nurture their soul or that act counter to their values. And may they all find ways to the fulfillment they have meant that they are meant for as human beings, offering skills of value and finding appreciation for what they have to give. So at this time, this weekend of honoring work and workers, we have to notice the challenges of justice within our economic system, the need for just wages, just opportunities, fairness in the workplace and the marketplace. May we do all we can in our particular roles to embody and make real that justice and fairness. May we have the strength and courage, the patience and perspective to continue to shape our work and that of others in the model of beloved community. May we have help to build a new world in the midst of the old. So may it be. Let's join together now in singing hymn number 109 as we come marching, marching, better known as Bread and Roses. Of Labor Day, may we keep in mind those who have suffered that we may have what we have. May we find dignity in our work and in that of others. May our work make the world a better place. May we have and appreciate both the bread and the roses. Amen.